The Spendthrift 80s, Part 4, Toys. Now, at the close of the decade, Toy and Hobby World published a list of the 20 top-selling toys in a year when the retail sales of toys in the United States reached a staggering $13.4 billion. A glance at the rating reveals that one video game manufacturer, Nintendo, played in 20% of American homes, dominated all other toy fads. Nintendo Entertainment System, number 1, followed by the company's game Super Mario Bros. 3, number 2, its Game Boy handheld system, number 4, its Tetris game, number 6, its Super Mario Bros. Number 2 game, number 9, and its Final Fantasy game, number 12. A business publication reported that for the latter part of the decade, Nintendo stymied the growth of traditional toy industry. Nintendo Videos entered the market in 1985. They offered superior graphics in a highly sophisticated computer about the size of a family Bible that rested next to the television set. The games of fantasy, sports, and combat were intricately designed by the Japanese computer company, and kids found them addictive. So too did many adults, especially men. The unassuming mustachioed Mario was the star character, followed by his brother Luigi. Creations of Japanese software engineer Shigeru Miyamoto. Legend has it that Mario received his name from the landlord of the building that housed Nintendo's American staff. By 1989, Super Brothers Mario and Luigi were so popular they had their own Saturday morning cartoon. A cereal was named after them, and their images were emblazoned on lunchboxes, underwear, bed linens, and licensing-like. Nintendo had single-handedly revived the home video game market, which began in 1981 with the munching menace known as Pac-Man, itself based on a Japanese folk hero known as the Voracious Appetite. Just when Nintendo madness seemed to have peaked, poised for inevitable sales dive, the company introduced a new action-packed product, Game Boy, a handheld version of the home video. The mania for video games in general, and Nintendo games in particular, prompted voluminous criticism. In the article entitled Pathological Preoccupation with Video Games, appearing in 1990 issue of the Journal of American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, the author claims that many games, quote, deliberately promoted habituation, end of quote, and introduced in children an altered state of consciousness akin to a hypnotic trance. Other critics argue that it was precisely the state many busy parents wanted their children in, mesmerized, inactive, and out of mischief for hours at a time. Is it good for kids? We'll have to wait for the answer until Nintendo generation enters adulthood. Here's how other hit toys rated in the national sales. Barbie by Mattel, number 3. Introduced in the New York Toy Fair in 1959, the shapely fashion model was still selling briskly at the toy age of 30. At the close of the 80s, Barbie accounted for more than half of the company's growth in sales. Reflecting the ethnic mix of America's population, there were Hispanic Barbies, Black Barbies, and Asian Barbies. Though it's worth noting, the only doll featured in print and TV advertising was the fair-skinned, blue-eyed original. In the 90s, however, Barbie ads would go ethnic as Mattel attempted to capitalize on the country's ethnic spending power. WrestleMania, which we examined earlier, influenced toy sales in the decade, with Hasbro's World Wrestling Federation figures ranking as 16th top toy of the decade. The company's New Kids on the Block, based on the pop singing group, was number 18. Though the decade witnessed manias over Strawberry Shortcake in 1980, Trivial Pursuit in 1984, and Teddy Ruxpin in 1985, it was the top seller of 1983 that caused riots in department stores and merited a Christmas season cover of Newsweek. Cabbage Patch Kids. The dough-faced, chinless dolls in high demand and short supply were termed the Holy Grail of the 1983 Christmas shopping season. At a store in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, one shopper suffered a broken leg when she was caught in the hysteria of 1,000 charging parents who waited 8 hours to get a grab at the homely dolls. Another store, an advancing mob of buyers, was held at bay by a baseball bat welding department manager. A shipload of Cabbage Patch Kids was delivered to a toy store in Middleton, Connecticut in an armored car. Fearing a riot, the manager of a Woolworth store in Lawrence, Kansas, placed his last 7 dolls in a bank vault and held a lottery for the privilege of buying them. The press was filled with reports of parents caught up in a Cabbage Patch madness. Kansas City postman, despairing of finding a doll in the Western Hemisphere, flew to London to get one of his 5-year-old daughter. but the most illustrative incident of the magnitude of the mania involved a Milwaukee radio station that fictitiously broadcast that 2,000 dolls would be tossed out of a B-29 circling over County Stadium. The announcer said as part of the lark that it would be an airborne delivery and the customers should bring catcher's mitts and credit cards to be photographed from the air. Astonishingly, more than 24 gullible adults showed up in the frigid December weather, gazing skyward, searching for the great cabbage patch drop. Now, the soft dolls, with pudgy cheeks, set eyes, and short, stunted arms and legs, which were not purchased but adopted, were based on the 1977 designs of Georgia sculptor Xavier Roberts, who took his inspiration from the work of Appalachian folk artists. Though the dolls were adorable in a facial, unfinished way, their primary appeal rested on Roberts' marketing gimmick. As a child, he had been told that babies are found in cabbage patches, a variation of the stork's fairy tale. Roberts dubbed his Georgia art gallery Babyland General Hospital, dressed his sales clerks as doctors and nurses, and placed his dolls in incubators and bassinets, and sold each doll by putting it up for adoption and making the transaction official with a birth certificate and adoption papers. A child had to swear an oath of adoption for the doll, as well as to a list of promises to take care of the infant. The brilliant ploy in the mass marketing hands of Coleco Industries brought in more than $60 million in sales in the year the dolls debuted. Each one-of-a-kind doll was actually manufactured in Hong Kong, with a minutely differentiated feature determined by a computer program. The buying blitz was fanned by several celebrities. Dr. Joyce Brothers endorsed the dolls as healthy playthings for children. And then-pregnant host of Today Show, Jane Pauley, played with the dolls, giving them 5 minutes of precious airtime and priceless publicity. In addition, several real hospitals set aside days in which children could bring in their dolls for vaccinations. Though Cabbage Patch Kids did not achieve the classic status and accompanying sales longevity of Barbie, teddy bears, and Raggedy Ann, the Dumpy Dimple dolls were a fad of major proportions. Sales peaked in 1985 at $600 million, after which the dolls were eclipsed by other hot toys. They also generated a host of imitations: Blossom Babies, Cauliflower Babies, and Garbage Pail Kids. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. For a generation of children, Michelangelo, Raphael, Leonardo, and Donatello are not the names of Renaissance greats, but of wisecracking, pizza-throwing, sewer-surfing superhero reptiles, the masters of martial arts. "Let's haul shell out of here," they bellow. In an animated cartoon series, the heroes on the half-shell conquered Saturday morning primetime kiddie TV audiences. They were also responsible for one of the top-grossing movies of 1990 and generated hundreds of millions in dollars in toy merchandising. The hip rap music-singing dudes, originally created for comic books by Kevin Eastman and Peter Laird, became the licensing success of 1989. The revered phrase heard throughout the toy industry was "turtle power." In 1990, the tough-shelled quartet held 3 of the top 10 videos for children and appeared in some 300 turtle merchandise spin-offs ranging from breakfast cereals to skateboards. The unlikely heroes debuted as static black-and-white comic book figures in 1983. At the time, 29-year-old Laird was barely earning enough money to pay his rent by illustrating vegetables for the garden section of an East Coast newspaper. 20-year-old Eastman was a cartoonist working as a short-order cook. During a brainstorming session one night in 1983, the two friends, desperately seeking commercial success, dreamed up the idea of a slow-poke turtle transformed by a ninja mask into a swift martial arts dude wielding a katana blade. The incongruity amused Lord and Eastman, and by evening's end they had sketched 4 creatures, borrowing from 2 hot trends in comic books, ninjas and mutants, christened their creations Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Gradually, Laird and Eastman developed their storyline. As any 10-year-old can explain, the 4 ordinary turtles were accidentally dropped down a sewer manhole, falling into a radioactive goo, which caused them to grow to human size and acquire the power to speak, and hiply so. The mutations adopted by a mutant sewer rat, Splinter, master of ninja fighting techniques, are named by Splinter after his favorite Renaissance artists. Leonardo is the group's leader, Raphael the rebel, Michelangelo the jokester, and Donatello the technical whiz. Turtle mania struck the nation only after a New York licensing agent, Mark Friedman, realized the creatures would make great toys and even better TV cartoon series. Suddenly, Laird and Eastman found themselves multimillionaires. By the close of the decade, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles by Playmate was the country's number 5 top-selling toy, topped only by Barbie and 3 Nintendo products. Only time will tell if the fad wanes into nostalgic memory, or if the wacky, bodacious dudes, whose violence was uniformly criticized throughout the media, enter the licensing hall of fame in the company of Mickey Mouse, Woody Woodpecker, and Pink Panther. Is turtle power here to stay, or merely the power of the hour? Well, I think you can answer that question. It's here to stay. They still manufacture those. And this is an interesting period in the 80s, because my oldest daughter was born in 1980. In 1983, my second daughter was born. So we were right in on this. Now, to get a Cabbage Patch doll, that's one of the advantages of being a teacher. I had students who worked in the toy store area, and when they got really, really, really popular, a couple of the kids would simply, they were allowed an allotment from their company that they worked for, and they would bring them to school and offer them for sale to various people at a very highly inflated price. But I was able to get them for $50, which was a pretty bargain. It's about twice the price, but they were really nice. So our kids had those. And as far as Teddy Ruxpin, we still have Teddy Ruxpin. He still works. Still has his Christmas outfit on, along with his other outfit. That was what we usually called in the family a Christmas miracle. I went around the toy stores once a week because I was selling stuff that they were, you know, cutting back and selling it through my little company. It's mostly science fiction stuff. But on the 23rd of December, I walk into a retail toy store, and they just put out a new display of Teddy Ruxpin. I'm the first guy in the store. There's nobody else there. I just bought one. I should have bought more and sold some excess for profit. And I may have told you the story about our first PlayStation that happened to come on Christmas Eve, and we weren't expecting that until the following year. So we always had something. I was pretty good at finding the hard object for Christmas. The source for this is Panotti's Parade of Fads, Follies, and Manias, The Origins of Our Most Cherished Obsessions by Charles Panotti. So I hope you enjoyed that. And as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, and check out our merchandise. Thank you very much.